This is Jonathan Smith.
A few years ago, Jonathan Smith traveled across the U.S. digging up dirt on local jails, and he told us about this pattern he noticed. This is how it would start. He'd get a tip about a jail from a lawyer or a judge.
We heard that prisoners were not getting treatment, or that there was a rash of suicides or murders that occurred in the institution.
Up until 2015, Jonathan was the head of an office in the Department of Justice that investigated civil rights violations in jails and prisons.
We would go into institutions and we would find that people who had severe and serious chronic illnesses were not getting treatment.
Like people with heart conditions or diabetes who weren't getting medications.
Persons with mental illness, instead of receiving treatment, were often confined in solitary confinement.
There was violence by guards.
We saw a significant amount of sexual assault.
Jonathan's team would gather this information and write it up into big, thick reports that basically told the jails, you're violating the Constitution. You need to clean up your act. And over the 5 years he did this, Jonathan says that something troubling kept on happening. He'd send his report to the jail, citing awful violations. But when he'd hear back, the jails would offer up the same defense.
They said, how could you find these problems? But we were told by the marshals that this was not a problem.
The marshals. That's the U.S. Marshals Service.
The United States Marshals Service had come in, conducted a review, and had given the facility a clean bill of health.
The marshals told these jails, thumbs up. You're good. From NPR and Futuro Media, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today, we bring you a first-ever look into the complex detention system run by the U.S. Marshals, a year-long investigation with Mother Jones and Type Investigations. When people think of the U.S. Marshals, they usually think of something along the lines of the fugitive.
Listen up, ladies and gentlemen. Our fugitive has been on the run for 90 minutes.
Where Tommy Lee Jones' character goes after Harrison Ford on a nail-biting manhunt.
Go get him.
The U.S. Marshals are one of the oldest law enforcement agencies in the country. The first ones were appointed by George Washington back in 1789. On a basic level, the marshals, which is part of the Department of Justice, is the enforcement arm of the federal courts. So they chase down fugitives and detain people facing federal criminal charges. These days, detention has become their biggest job. Basically, when someone's charged with a federal crime, they hold them until they're sentenced or set free. In recent decades, the number of marshals' detainees has spiked. First, because of the war on drugs.
Drugs are menacing our society. They're threatening our values and undercutting our institutions.
And then, because of the war on immigrants.
Undocumented men and women swept up for immigration violations. Critics call this assembly line justice.
Over the past couple of years, since Trump's been criminally prosecuting almost everyone caught crossing the border.
If you cross the border unlawfully, then we will prosecute you. If you are smuggling,
those numbers
a child,
have skyrocketed.
Then we will prosecute you. And that child may be separated from you as required by.
Our story today comes from Seth Fried Wessler. He's a reporter with Type Investigations. Seth has spent the last year digging into how the marshals run this really obscure system that they've set up to detain people.
Every day, the U.S. Marshals Service is responsible for detaining around 60,000 people. For context, that's more people than ICE detains every day, and it includes people facing border crossing charges, but also charges for drugs, guns, a whole range of things. But the marshals don't run their own detention centers.
They have agreements to pay more than 1,000 facilities all over the country to lock people up for them. These are mostly local jails, and Seth wanted to find out, what was happening in these jails?
I've been reporting on federal criminal justice for years, and I've often heard from prisoners that no matter how bad federal prison was, the worst time for them was when they were being held by the marshals.
So a few years ago, Seth sent a Freedom of Information Act request to find out more about how the U.S. Marshals were treating people.
The government is supposed to respond to these requests within a few weeks or months, but they weren't getting back to me. So I sued them.
Seth worked with a lawyer pro bono. They went before a federal judge in New York, and then finally, reluctantly, the marshals started to send him records.
It was mountains of documents, and they're still coming in. Government oversight reports and piles of records about medical care.
Seth found things that nobody had seen before about how the U.S. Marshals run this detention system.
And then I found this one family whose story reflects almost everything that's going on. Yeah. I went to Gardendale, Texas to visit them.
Yeah. Who cooked that?
I meet Sadrak Garcia on the one-acre lot that his dad bought some years ago as a family compound. It's dusty and flat, and oil pumps are sticking out of the ground all over the place. He's grilling steaks. It smells great. While they're cooking, Sadrak goes inside his brother's house and returns with a plastic photo album.
That's him right there. The same grill right there. Oh, wow. That's a great picture.
Can you send this one to me?
Yeah. Sadrak's dad used to grill like this almost every summer evening, though his dad preferred to cook goat.
Wow, nice goat.
Yeah. I'm closing on the house tomorrow.
You are?
Sadrak used to live here too, right next to his parents. But he sold his house a couple of months ago, and now he's closing on a new one closer to town.
Something else, something different. I mean, trying to not forget, because that's going to be hard, but move on and like, see if that'll help. Because, be honest with you, I mean, I think about it every day. Like, that's like, for me, it's an everyday deal for me.
The story I'm here to talk to Sadrak about, in a way, it starts back in the mid-1980s, when Sadrak was a baby.
I was born here in the U.S., a little town called Fort Stockton, Texas.
Sadrak's parents were from another little town, one just south of the border. But they spent a lot of time in Texas, where his dad poured concrete and did other odd jobs.
They used to come over here and work for a little bit and then go back to Mexico to a little place called Piedritas, Texas. I mean, not Texas. We used to call it Piedritas, Texas.
Because as far as they were concerned, it might as well have been Texas. Back then, going back and forth across the border wasn't that big a deal. But as Sadrak was growing up, U.S. border enforcement started to get a lot more intense. And on one of these routine crossings, Sadrak's dad, his name is Isaac, got picked up. He was detained, and then he was deported. Sadrak and his brother and his two sisters, they're all U.S. citizens. They were born here. And as they got older, they built their lives here.
I moved to Florida. I started working over there, doing construction.
And with their kids in the U.S., it seemed to Sadrak's parents that it was time to pick one side of the border to stay on.
I guess they thought it'd be better for them to come over here and like try to be closer, you know, or make it easier to go visit or whatever.
His father came back to the U.S., and eventually Sadrak's family saved up and bought this piece of land in West Texas. And the parents and the kids and the grandkids all live there together. One spring morning 2 years ago, Sadrak and his dad were planning to spend the day together fixing Sadrak's truck. But then his dad got a call from a cousin who came to pick him up.
And then a few hours after that, I mean, we got the call that they got arrested or whatever. And, well, that brought us to where we are right now. I mean, everything that happened after that.
What happened that morning is that Sadrak's cousin got pulled over for speeding. The officer said he found open bottles of alcohol and two tiny bags of cocaine when he searched the cousin's car. He arrested both of the men. And Isaac didn't have ID, so the officer called Border Patrol to report him. Later that day, Isaac called his wife from the Tom Green County Jail in the city of San Angelo.
After that, we just went to my cousin's house and because he got out.
Sadrak's cousin could get out on bond because he's a U.S. citizen, but Isaac isn't. And remember, Isaac had that old deportation, so he could now be charged with illegal reentry. That's a federal felony. He was charged with a federal crime.
Marshals took over him because of that reentry or whatever.
He was now a U.S. Marshals detainee. Remember, the Marshals don't have their own facilities, so they left him right there in the Tom Green County Jail. That's because they had an agreement with the jail. The Marshals would pay $53 a day per person for the jail to hold their detainees. For the first couple of months, Isaac was just waiting there to be sentenced. But then, Isaac, who was then 51 years old, started to feel unwell. In the infirmary, he told a nurse that he was having intense pain in his back and shoulder, and that he was having a hard time breathing.
Casi nada más conmigo hablaba. Y él me decía, dile a los muchachos que me ayuden.
That's Isaac's wife, Sadrak's mom, Yesenia. She says Isaac started calling her and asking her to tell their kids to get him help.
Y luego dice, es que ya fui, no me dicen nada, no me hacen nada. Me dan unas aspirinas, dice, pero no se me quita el dolor.
They were giving some aspirins and stuff like that, but he told us that that wasn't helping, that he's like, it's something else.
Medical records show that Isaac said his pain was getting worse. A jail nurse asked a sergeant if they should send him to the hospital, but the sergeant said no. He said Isaac had been complaining about different illnesses all week. In other words, he thought he was exaggerating.
Y me decía, que si estoy malo de veras, me decía él.
Like he was calling us every day, at least five times or more, like every single day, that he was in pain and that they weren't doing enough.
His family knew his pain was getting worse and worse, even if the jail staff didn't believe him.
He's like, I can't feel my arms anymore. I already felt one, two times.
He started having a hard time standing up at all.
He had no energy and he wasn't feeling his arms or his legs.
2 days after that, Sadrak went to the jail to visit.
It was actually my birthday. I was working and he called me and I left work. I told him, you know what? I'm going to go out there and see what's going on.
When he got to the jail, it took longer than usual for Isaac to be brought out so they could talk. That seemed like a bad sign. Sadrak says he waited for a couple of hours. Then Isaac appeared.
When I finally saw him, he told me that this is too much. It's like, I can't take it anymore. I mean, it's do something. It's like, do something for me.
Sadrak says he asked officials at the jail if he could bring in a private doctor, but they refused. They told him they had Isaac's care under control. And then Sadrak had one last idea.
I mean, I realized or remembered that he was in the marshal's custody. So, I mean, they could go. I mean, if they don't know, they could go or make them get him out and take him to a different place or another doctor.
He drove to the U.S. Marshal's office a few blocks away. But he says all he found was a receptionist.
It wasn't nobody to talk to.
So he left. A day went by with no news. That night, his dad collapsed in his cell and was sent back to the infirmary. The next morning, the jail finally made plans to send Isaac to the hospital. Even then, a nurse told an officer that his case wasn't urgent. Several more hours passed.
So the next day, I got a call from the prison. Are you Cedric Garcia? I'm like, yeah. He's like, I was just going to let you know that your dad is in the hospital right now. It's in ICU. I'm like, damn.
Sadrak rushed to the hospital, to the ICU. And the staff there could tell right away what Sadrak had known for a week. His dad was seriously ill.
One of the nurses got to us and she asked us, Are you familiar with this? I saw him when they brought him here. I saw him, and she told us that he was kind of like hallucinating. Like, he was saying that he wanted to go back to Mexico, that he was going to go back over there, and I think it just let go.
Isaac was already unconscious by the time Sadrak got to the hospital room, and 2 days later, Isaac died.
After two or almost 3 weeks asking for help, it was gone.
once I got my hands on Isak's medical file, I had two independent doctors evaluate it. Isak died of organ failure and sepsis, which is what can happen if you don't get treatment for an infection. Your body responds with this whole chain reaction that can shut down your organs and kill you. The doctor said that each delay in getting Isak treatment almost certainly reduced his chances of survival. And Isak isn't the only Marshall's detainee who's died after being denied the care they needed. As I dug through the pages and pages of medical records, I kept finding detainees who died under troubling conditions. The data I got shows that in just 3 years, 158 people died in U.S. Marshals custody. And if you go back a few more years, it's hundreds and hundreds of people.
I mean, they did it. The Marshals did it. The guys on the prison did it. The whole system, the whole law or whatever they want to call it, I mean, they did it.
Coming up on Latino USA, our investigation into the U.S. Marshals Service and their detention system continues.
I mean, obviously, you can draw your own conclusions, but you've seen the inspection document and things, and it doesn't really lend to a lot of, real digging.
Stay with us. No te vayas.
Maddie Sofia here, host of a new daily science podcast from NPR called Shortwave. This week, the first all-female spacewalk. We got to talk to both of those astronauts in space.
We have you loud and clear, NPR.
Listen for that and subscribe to Shortwave from NPR.
We're back, and I'm here in the studio with Seth Fried Wessler, and we're talking about his reporting with Mother Jones and Type Investigations. And before the break, Seth brought us a really terrible story about a man named Isak Garcia Wessler, who died while he was being detained by the U.S. Marshals Service. So, Seth, you followed this story of Isak Garcia, and you actually got a hold of some of the videos from his last days, right?
Yeah, so on top of going to West Texas to visit Isak's family, I got these records from that lawsuit. And I also got my hands on the jail's surveillance videos from the last days that he was held there. The video doesn't have any sound, but I'd like to show it to you because all of this is evidence of what went wrong in this case. This first video is of Isak walking into the medical clinic in this county jail. This is about 9 days before he died.
So this is him?
This is Isak, and he's standing here in front of a cell. And as you can see, he's walking.
Oh, he points to his right shoulder and the back of his neck.
So the records show Isak going to the clinic, talking to guards and nurses, asking for help, because he's saying over and over again that he's in really intense pain, and it keeps getting worse and worse. This is sort of the very beginning of that process.
Okay.
And then here's another video from just under a week later, when Isak was finally taken to the hospital.
All right, so he's coming out in a wheelchair, but then the wheelchair turns around and then we're looking straight at him as he's being wheeled out backwards, and now we're seeing the front of his body. His feet are completely dragging.
He's not able to hold himself up.
Correct.
His head is slumped to the side, and, this is a change that happens in a period of less than a week. And the medical records show clearly that Isak was trying to get help for that entire period of time. And by the next day, Isak was totally unconscious. And 3 days later, he died in that hospital nearby.
Okay, so basically, Isak dies from something that is treatable, And then what you do, Seth, is that you go deep into your reporting and you find this number, 158 people who have died over the last 3 years while they were in Marshall's custody. I mean, that's a lot of people.
It is a lot of people. And it's actually the first time anybody's ever gotten the full death count for people held in Marshall's detention. And it turns out the death rate is actually way higher than the rate of death of ICE detainees, which is something that we actually do hear about.
Right. People are aware. But we don't know about it happening when they're being held by U.S. Marshals.
The Marshals are kind of like the invisible giant in the American detention system. People don't really see them, and they don't really talk about them.
So going back to Isaac Garcia Huizlar, you have this whole paper trail showing that this jail messed up in a pretty massive way. What happened then after Isaac died?
Yeah, one of the most shocking things about all of this is that it appears nothing really happened. You know, the Marshals have access to all of these documents that I have, and there's no indication that the Marshals ever really investigated what happened. In fact, the Marshals did one of their annual inspections of this jail a year after Isaac died, and it included a category to check on medical care. They said the jail was doing just fine.
Seth, why don't you take it from here?
So even after this death, the Marshals gave the jail a stamp of approval, and I found this over and over again in my reporting.
I mean, they're there every year to look at those facilities and they give them a clean bill of health, despite the fact that the pattern of violations exist. It's concerning.
That's Jonathan Smith again, the former Department of Justice civil rights lawyer who we heard from at the beginning. Remember, he talked about how these jails he would investigate for all sorts of failures, like shoddy medical care or violence. A lot of them would come back to him saying,
"We were just told by the marshals that we're okay," or "Why isn't the United States speaking with one voice?
Why are these two federal agencies contradicting each other?" The marshals have agreements with about a third of the local jails in the U.S., and each jail they put people in, they send inspectors to those jails every year. During my investigation, I reviewed these annual inspection reports from dozens of facilities around the country, in Ohio, in Texas, in California. I looked at facilities I knew were troubled because other state and federal agencies had found serious, even deadly problems there. But when the marshals went in, they filed rosy reports. Jonathan saw the same thing.
And what we learned was that it was very much a checkbox review. It wasn't a serious look at whether or not what the facility was saying that it did to ensure that people's rights were protected was what was in fact happening inside the facility.
This became a big deal for Jonathan around a decade ago when his team was investigating the now notorious Sheriff Joe Arpaio in Arizona.
Yes, I remember that.
Many who've gone through his jails, including his desert tent city, have long accused Arpaio of violating their rights.
And the Marshal Service had housed a large number of detainees in the sheriff's facilities.
So the marshals had been inspecting those facilities every year for years.
And the sheriff, throughout our investigation, which found extremely serious issues, maintained throughout that this was all about politics and not about civil rights violations.
Why are they going after this sheriff? Well, we know why. Because they don't like me enforcing illegal immigration law.
And they did throw back at us the investigations that were done by the Marshal Service.
Just like the jail where Isaac was held, the marshals had given Arpaio's jails a bunch of positive inspections. And this happens in jails all over the country. In my reporting, I found that a big part of the problem is that the marshals didn't design these inspections to dig much up.
It was a very cursory review. It was a completion of a reform.
I've got hundreds of these inspection forms, and they're really very basic. Just a series of yes or no checkboxes, and people who do them, they're scarcely trained. Some of the worst examples were in Texas. There were several jails there where Texas state inspectors found that guards hadn't checked on suicidal marshals detainees, detainees who later killed themselves. And even after that, the marshals kept sending people there. The fact that the marshals don't keep good tabs on the local jails, it doesn't totally fit with the agency's history. That's because the marshal's role has always been to enforce federal law when local law enforcement wouldn't. There's definitely a dark side to that history. For example, before the Civil War, marshals chased down people trying to escape slavery. But they've also been a force for good. Fast forward to the 60s, and they enforced court orders that were crucial to civil rights.
The mothers of downtown New Orleans screaming at a Negro child.
Standing alongside Ruby Bridges on her first day at an all-white school in Louisiana.
She entered the William Franz Elementary School, first in the city to be integrated.
Marshals I talked to, they're proud of this civil rights history. One of them is Jack Hildebrand.
As you can see, there's a little bit of memorabilia.
He served in the marshals starting in the 1990s. He's retired from that now, and he works for a police department in Amarillo, Texas. But his office is still crowded with marshals memorabilia.
Here on top of the files, you'll see all these what we call challenge coins.
He's got challenge coins from a few missions, plaques, awards.
I've got more at home, but even here in my office here at the Amarillo Police Department, I have, you know, room and space for some of these things.
Jack started from the bottom. He was a deputy in San Diego and here in Amarillo, but he worked his way up, and by 2012, he was the guy in charge of detention.
I was in Washington, D.C. at Marshal Service Headquarters as the acting chief of detention operations.
And while he was in D.C., there was this debate going on inside the Justice Department. It was between the marshals and this thing called the Office of the Federal Detention Trustee.
Many of the folks over at the Office of Federal Detention Trustee wanted to push for those higher standards. There was kind of a momentum from them wanting to do that.
Their idea was that the federal government was going to require local jails to meet high standards. They were going to make sure that conditions were good.
And of course, then that kind of came in conflict again with, you know, the official marshals' position that we really need the beds.
So marshals' officials pushed back on that approach. They were scared that if they started to enforce those higher standards, that the jails would kick the marshals out. And in 2013, this was just after Jack retired, the marshals won the debate. That meant that they stuck with cursory inspections done by minimally trained deputies.
You're walking a fine line there between, you know, the needs of the beds, the needs of the marshal service, and, the needs of the particular district and the housing and the facilities. So, I mean, obviously, you can draw your own conclusions, but you've seen the inspection document. It doesn't really lend to a lot of real digging.
I talked to the marshal's official spokesperson about what their standards are now. His name is Drew Wade.
All right, are we all here?
And about why their inspections keep failing to catch serious problems, like the care that led up to Isak's death. Just a heads up that my colleague was typing notes while we talked.
So the goal is for our detainees to be housed in a manner that's consistent with federal law.
He's saying that the goal now is to follow high standards.
But it's not required of them. Is that sort of the distinction that I'm hearing? I can't really say anything more than I just did. I mean, that's where we are.
So the marshals don't require that the jails follow those high standards. Remember, the marshals have to detain tens of thousands of people every day all over the country. And the marshals worry that if they impose high standards, then the jails have to follow them. And if the jails don't do that, where would the marshals put people? But I talked to a lot of current and former marshals officials, and they told me that this logic, it's kind of off, because actually, the jails probably aren't going to kick them out. The jails rely on the marshals' money.
I mean, we were like the big customer or the main customer. And, you know, unlike their local jurisdictions, the Marshals Service would obviously, you know, financially pay for the services provided. And so that was, you know, huge for them.
Jack, the former marshals official, says jails were eager to please the marshals because of all the money they were getting. The marshals pay these facilities an average of about $70 per person each day, and that money adds up. The year Isak died, the marshals paid the jail where he was held more than $250,000. they pay other jails millions. He says, sure, finding enough beds can be complicated. But at the end of the day, the Marshals Service is actually in an ideal position to raise standards on local jails around the country. And I heard this repeatedly from other Marshals officials I talked to. County jails can be uniquely horrible places to be. They have high death rates, and often nobody's really keeping tabs on them. So for a lot of those jails, the Marshals could act as a watchdog.
Everything is there for that to possibly take place. And the Marshals Service has a unique position that probably no one else in the country has to do that because of the day-to-day operation they have with so many jails. So certainly everything is in place. It's just, you know, is that a direction that the agency is going to go or willing to go?
In other words, the Marshals have power, and they're missing an opportunity to use it to protect the rights and the lives of federal detainees.
Can we walk over here?
Yeah.
When I visited Sadrak Garcia out in West Texas, he walked me around the land that his dad had bought before he died.
Your dad liked it here?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he liked it a lot. It was pretty happy. We had, back then, we had some goats, like, on back over here. So we would come out here and mess with the goats and feed the goats and stuff like that.
Did you think much about him and the fact that he didn't have papers? And was that something you all thought much about?
No, I mean, like, we didn't actually, or I didn't care about papers. I mean, I just, all I thought, I mean, it's just the fact that he was here with us and we were together, I mean, as a family.
When Sadrak thinks about what happened to his dad, he says he's not angry that Isaac got picked up or even that he was probably going to get deported.
I was thinking, like, I don't know, people in Mexico, the life in Mexico, it is harder over there. But even like that, I mean, you see people from Mexico or in Mexico, you see them much happier. I don't know. There's something different, man. People here, I mean, we have a little bit more stuff or a little bit more opportunities or whatever to make a better life. But you're always under a lot of pressure. I don't know, it just feels more pressure.
Sadrak thought it would be okay for his parents to settle back in Mexico. They'd still be close enough for him to go visit.
What I'm trying to say is it's not, I'm not mad with the laws or whatever because he was gonna get deported. I mean, I'm kind of mad or sad or what I don't like is that he died in there. You know, he didn't get the chance to go back.
If his dad hadn't died, Sadrak would have stayed here. And just like they'd done when he was a kid, he'd have gone to visit his father just over the border. But now Sadrak is moving off the land to try to move on.
The Marshals spent more than $1.6 billion on detention in just the last year. These taxpayer dollars help sustain these jails. But it's money spent without oversight, without keeping tabs on how detainees, our relatives, our neighbors and friends, are being treated. Thanks to reporter Seth Fried Wessler, this story was a partnership with Type Investigations and Mother Jones. You can read the full investigation at motherjones.com. This episode was produced by Alisa Escarce and Seth Fried Wessler, with help from Miguel Macias and Ginny Montalvo, and edited by Fernanda Camarena. The Latino USA team includes Sofia Paliza Ka, Antonia Cerejido, Maggie Freeling, and Janice Yamoka, with help from Maya Cueva. Fact-checking by Daniel Moatar and Jacob Rosenberg. Special thanks this week to editors Esther Kaplan from Type Investigations and Clara Jaffrey from Mother Jones, and to attorneys Jessica Hunter and Dave Pollack. Our engineers are Stephanie LeBeau and Julia Caruso. Additional engineering this week by Leah Shaw. Our production manager is Natalia Fidelholt. Our digital team includes Julio Ricardo Varela and Amanda Alcantara. Our New York Women's Foundation Ignite Fellow is Fernanda Uriegas. Our interns are Adriana Tapia and Juan Diego Ramirez. Our theme music was composed by Zenia Rubinos. If you like the music you heard on this episode, stop by latinousa.org and check out our weekly Spotify playlist. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again on our next episode. And in the meantime, look for us on all of your social media. Hasta la próxima. Chao.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the New York Women's Foundation, funding women leaders that build solutions in their communities and celebrating 30 years of radical generosity. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. And the Annie E. Casey Foundation creates a brighter future for the nation's children by strengthening families, building greater economic opportunity, and transforming communities.
I'm Maria Hinojosa, and next time on Latino USA, we bring you one of our How I Made It segments, this time with the Latin Grammy-winning all-female mariachi group, Flor de Toloache. That's next time on Latino USA.